idea. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. A woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Cause you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Cause when them old boys raise on shotguns, we say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land.
butt and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Thank you. here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, it's old Shaziz here. You're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html. You probably have to excuse me today. I'm not feeling so well, so if I seem a little sluggish or off of my game, that's why. Anyway, at some point in the game, I've got Raymond here today, but at some point in the game, there might be somebody showing up to talk about tiny houses, and so we'll see how that goes. Nonetheless, jump over there to the superchat.html. I posted over some video links, one of Don Smith and the device that he's been working with, and another of somebody essentially basically trying to debunk Don Smith's device. a whole lot of that going on in the alternative energy community. It ain't a wonder why everybody keeps bailing out and giving up. But the point I put out there for each one of these videos is to try to explain the difference between what it is that I'm attempting to do and what it is that some or the majority of the alternative energy researchers out there are going for. Some folks are looking for 0 points, some folks are looking for over unity, and I always say I aim to prove free energy for the world once and for all. These first couple videos that I posted, one being Lid Motor and the other one being Slider, let's see, 2732, both got something in common because they work on these little motors that they're running off of everything from LEDs to grapes to solar panels and using supercapacitors and basically little like... Oh, what the heck you call those doggone things? Doggone it. It was right there on the tip of my tongue, and I can't remember it. Give me a second here. Jewel Thief Circuit. So much to remember. Anyway, they're using these like these the equivalents of a little Jewel Thief Circuit with supercapacitors and basically running these pulse motors off of microamps. Now see, that is closer to what it is that I'm talking about. The on the opposite side of the spectrum, the other videos that I posted speak about over unity, essentially getting out more than you put in. When I talk about free energy, I'm not talking about trying to get out more than I put in. Basically, an example of what it is that I'm trying to say is if you got a gallon of water and it's in a closed loop circuit, and as long as there's no leaks in that pipe, then you can move that water around inside that pipe and never lose any of the energy inside that pipe. You know, if there's an air pocket in there, there's a little bit of atmosphere going on, and there's a gallon of water, no matter where that water is in that pipe, it's still a gallon of water. Nonetheless, you ain't lost nothing. And so that's where the efficiency point of this whole game comes in. When they're able to get these little motors to run in the microamps on things such as in this one video I'm looking at here that Slider's done, he's got a green LED out in the sunlight, and that green LED is picking up enough energy to charge a capacitor that can run the pulse motor. They've also, Lid Motor's the one that did the one with the grape. He basically plugged in a couple different types of metals into a grape and used the grape as a battery to run these little pulse motors. I believe it's either Laser Saber or Laser Hacker or Rimstar.org. They might all be one and the same, just different names for different channels. I'm not sure. I can't remember anymore. But nonetheless, they have 3D printed some really amazing little electric motors that some of which have been running off of crystal cell batteries and different techniques in order to generate a little bit of electricity and such. And so the amazing portion of that is the fact that these things will run in the milliamp range. Microamp range. If you go out and look at these little, there's little toys that little solar powered toys that wobble back and forth. They're kind of neat to watch for about the first 5 minutes, and then you get like bored watching them. So you just kind of set them off there, and every once in a while look at them while they're doing their little dance in the window or whatever. Those things have really super efficient solar panels on them for their size, and they have really super efficient little motors inside there that are really a simple design. And they're able to, using physics and leverage and all that, be able to get this plastic thing to dance back and forth with very little input whatsoever. They'll even work off of ambient light in the room. And so that's more of the concept of what mad science is about. That's what we're trying to do, not to try to get out more than we put in. Free energy doesn't have to be more than you put in. Essentially, if you can make something run so incredibly efficient like these little motors do, and if they can be made on that scale, they could obviously be scaled up on a larger scale as well. But if you can make, whether it be an internal combustion engine or any device that you make, run so incredibly efficient with very little input on the inside, on the front side of it, then that's, to me, what needs to be done in order to basically prove once and for all free energy. The sunlight, when the sun's out, you can get thousands if not millions of kilowatts of power through solar panels and wind turbines. When the sun's out, you can also get heat transfers from the sun. And all of this energy from just the sun alone can be stored. Wind power, same thing. When you generate energy using wind power, you can store it. I have a friend that I hang out with a lot over here in my neighborhood that has put up a huge solar array out in his yard, and he's got windmills, two of them, one for high wind and one for low wind, and he's got a huge battery bank. And he's able to run his entire house off of the system that he's got designed. And so he's making use of everything nature's already provided. And for a backup, he has a small diesel generator that he only has to run on days when it ain't windy or days whenever the sun isn't out because of cloud cover or whatever. Nonetheless, he's completely 100% off the grid, not even connected to the main line anymore. And so to me, that's what I call free energy. Now, granted, he had to spend a lot of money to get all the stuff that he had. But when you mix those two things together, the money you had to spend for your equipment and the money, or the lack of money that you had to pay for the electricity once you've got the actual equipment, then as far as I'm concerned, once that equipment's in your hand and the energy that you're getting from the sun, the wind, the earth, a moving stream or whatever, hydroelectrics, thermoelectrics, any process that nature's already provided for you, that is, in my mind, proof 150,000% beyond a shadow of a doubt that energy's free. So, whereas some of these devices out there, such as solar panels, can get up into the thousands of dollars depending on how much energy usage you have, then, not everybody can get out there and do that. But everybody could start off small and build a small battery bank and work your way towards a better, more efficient system over time. But if you could take that same exact system and design everything that would be a load to that system in such a fashion that it is so energy efficient, then basically you're going to get more bang for your buck, if you understand what I'm trying to say. And so it's common sense and a little bit of wisdom and maybe even some trial and error, you'll get the system down perfectly the way you wanted it. My frustration here at Mad Science comes from all the things that I watch out there in the alternative energy community, where people are trying different things, and then, you know, over time, between the ridicule and the craziness and the shills or whatever you want, or people coming out to debunk every idea you got, or just basically foul-mouthing you for the fun of it, it's a hindrance to what needs to be done here in the world. On one hand, you got the people who believe in doom and gloom, such as Fukushima killing off the planet, or, you know, global warming slash climate change or climate disruption or whatever's going to be next week when the math doesn't add up. You got people that believe that the carbon emissions from your cars are causing problems and all this kind of jazz there. So when you get out there, it's like walking into a bee's nest. If you decide to dare to say that I'm going to prove that energy is free, you got to be expected that there are going to be those out there who are going to fight you with everything they got, including those who want free energy. They don't want to step outside the comfort zone of the school book. And I have this problem when I go to speak about mechanical devices such as the perfect engine plan that I got going on, that I want to build the perfect engine. When you talk about running a car on water or an engine on water, you get people that misconstrue or misunderstand what it is that you're trying to convey or point out to them, and they will basically fight you tooth and nail and ridicule you for even mentioning that it's possible. Regardless of the fact that science says that water is hydrogen and oxygen and the two separately will burn, regardless of the terminology, whether it's an explosion or implosion, you're always going to have somebody who has read the school books who doesn't believe that it's even remotely possible and believes that the second law of thermodynamics is God. Which is, you can't get out more energy than you put in. Now, I don't need to get out more energy than I put in. What I need is to be able to utilize whatever energy I have available to me in the most efficient manner possible. If you're running an internal combustion engine and the outside temperature of that internal combustion engine is so incredibly hot that you have to have a radiator and a water pump that basically keeps the temperature down, depending on what type of engine you're running or car, anywhere from 180 degrees to 220 degrees normal operating temperature. Science tells us that water will boil at 200 to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and anything over that will cause superheated steam. Superheated steam causes pressure, which in turn can be used to turn turbines. And so imagine if you have on your table a little steam engine that was built back in the early 1900s. The little steam engines back then, in them days, plugged into a 120 volt or 110 volt AC wall outlet. Plugged right into the wall. And it had a little heater element down there that would literally heat up the boiler and produce steam and then run this little steam engine. The version of engine that I keep trying to explain to people that they keep trying to pick apart because they don't understand the mechanics of what it is that I'm actually trying to convey to them. Basically, what you're looking at in one part of the process, one leg of this journey, is an electric steam engine. You're essentially using electricity through induction to heat water and to preheat a cylinder in the engine. And so even if it never makes it past step one, you still have an already existing technology that has been readily available since the early 1900s. You have a steam engine. And whether it be a four-stroke or two-stroke engine design or a new re-engineered design for a better power stroke, a better compression, nonetheless, it's already proven technology. The toy was sitting on your desk, remember? So you already know that it is possible to build an electric steam engine. So if you modify the specific engine that I'm talking about to literally run on steam, you have to know that you're going to have some voltage input. There's where the mathematicians and the physicists and the mechanics and all the educated individuals of the world will come out of the woodworks and tell you why it is that you will never be able to generate enough power to come back and charge the battery to keep that induction heater going. But what they don't understand and what they've overlooked in the process of keeping that induction heater going is that the induction heater doesn't remain on constant. So that adds another factor into the mathematics that has to be taken into consideration when doing the math. The induction heater only comes on when the thermostat tells the power source that it is below operating temperature that is preset by you. If you want it to run at 300 degrees, when it drops down below 300 degrees, it will sense that temperature change and it will tell the circuitry or whatever to kick a relay, shut the power off to the induction heater, and so you're no longer using the induction heater as a heat source. As the piston is going up and down inside the engine, it is it's creating compression, which in turn is creating heat, because we know from air compressor technology that when you compress air, or any gas for that matter, then you generate heat from the pressure. And so you have a bit of time before you have to kick that induction heater back on, before the temperature drops down to below operating temperature, which once again is preset by you, determining where you want this thing to run at. So at this point in the game, now it's all about where and how you're going to bring the fuel into the system. If you preheat your water using the induction heating, you've already got it ready. You've got the molecules inside the water basically agitated, and it's like a bee's nest inside the tube. They're buzzing around inside there. The water's all agitated. It's ready to go. And when you send it on down through the rest of the system, and then you atomize it, and then you vaporize it into the finest mist that you can possibly get, and then send it into that hot compressed chamber. The moment that water molecule hits that temperature and that pressure inside that chamber, it will begin to flash the steam and expand, pressing the piston down, which is basically how a steam engine works. It pushes the piston, which basically turns a big cam that has a big flywheel, that the flywheel is used to actually pull and assist the piston and the cam back around for the next cycle in line. If you look at all the engines out there, including the engine in your car, you'll note that there's a flywheel on it. The flywheel is to use the part of physics which we call centrifugal force, that will literally take the weight of the flywheel, the rotation of the flywheel, the weight mass and the RPM speed, whatever, to help to bring that system back around to where it needs to be for the next cycle, for the pressure to send that piston back down and repeat it again. So at this point in the game, you're running that engine like a steam engine. Now I say, and everyone else will argue, that once you get to a certain pressure and once you get to a certain temperature, because of the separation of the oxygen and the hydrogen in the water molecule, that you will literally build up electric charge inside that combustion chamber. That electric charge mixed with the oxygen, mixed with the hydrogen, and mixed with the pressure and the heat is enough for compression ignition. So at some point in the game, if you get the cylinder hot enough, you will basically get the equivalence of what occurred over at Fukushima as far as a hydrogen explosion, implosion, or whatever terminology you want to use. Nonetheless, it's going to release a lot of energy that is going to push the piston, which in turn is going to turn the camshaft and the crankshaft and the flywheel and cause it to come back around for the next go. So you can run an engine on water. Mythbusters tried to say that you couldn't run an engine on water. Of course, they made a mockery of it. And, of course, they basically did it the wrong way to begin with. They pumped pure hydrogen down into a carburetor with no flashback arrestor and got the obvious flashback because hydrogen is highly volatile and all you need is one simple spark and you'd be amazed at how fast that one simple spark will create a chain reaction and follow that fuel right back to its source. Of course, now with that, suddenly this is why we don't use hydrogen technology, because look at that, it's too dangerous. Well, as far as I'm concerned, the Mythbusters did a disservice to the world because they didn't explain why this actually occurred. And that done properly, that hydrogen would have run fine in that engine and would not had the opportunity to flash back. Therefore, we had flashback arrestors that would literally keep the flame, if it did flash, from riding all the way back down the hose or the fuel line to the source and creating a problem. And then you also have the fact that people will try to say that you don't get enough power out of burning hydrogen to basically run the engine, or that you can't get enough hydrogen built up on demand to run the engine. Then you also had some of the supposedly brilliant scientists of the world saying that you'd have to have a huge tanker full of hydrogen in order to be the equivalence of one tank full of gas in your car. All of these people that do this do a disservice to the world, because the technology that I'm talking about isn't science fiction. It's science fact. It's based on all proven science and physics. So with that said, it's not the engine itself. It's not even the engineering of the specific engines or whatever that is the problem. It's that these weren't designed to do what it is that people want to do with them. They weren't designed to run off of hydrogen specifically. They will run off of hydrogen. It just takes a little bit more doing in order to calculate out where you need to be and how much you need to put in there in order to not tear that engine apart. Now, from start to finish, if an engine is designed specifically for the purpose of running off of water, and I've already basically laid it out on how the first step of this thing, where you're preheating your fuel, which is the water, you're basically getting it ready, pre-treating it by exciting the molecules inside the water, bringing them almost to the point of steam, to where by the time you get this fuel to the intake portion of the vehicle or generator, whatever it is that you're going to use the power source for, that it's already ready to go. It's already pressurized, it's already superheated, it's already ready to dance. It's ready to just, once it hits that hot cylinder and basically is the straw that broke the camel's back, the tipping point in the process, and it produces a reaction. Now, water is the most stable molecule on the planet. Hydrogen and oxygen molecules don't like to be apart, and they will try to recombine themselves under the right circumstances. And heat is what basically is probably one of the drawbacks of every single device that tries to run electricity or fuel the way that it does, is heat is it can be your best friend or your worst enemy as far as damaging parts or whatever. But in the engine that I keep talking about, you want to take that energy of heat that is created, the process that you actually use to create that heat. And you want to do like the very first example that I talked about. If you got a gallon of water in a closed loop system, and as long as you have those pipes sealed, no escape for that energy, you can focus that energy to where you want it to go. Same thing that goes on with a boiler system. When you got a big drum that you heat the water up in, and then the steam goes down the pipe, and they send the pipe whichever direction, up and down around the corner, and so on, until it finally hits the turbine, and then does the job that basically it was meant to do, which is to turn a generator head or whatever device that they want to run with it. So what we're talking about here isn't trying to get out more power than you're putting in. What we're talking about here is making every system so energy efficient that you can basically afford to run it. Try to run an average gasoline generator all day long, every day, for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Number one, the price of fuel goes up and down on a regular basis, and so one day you might be paying more, one day you might be paying less. Nonetheless, you're still paying. Plus, the wasted energy that is being basically sent into the atmosphere around an air-cooled engine is just gone. It's gone. It's no longer around. It's out somewhere. And so, you basically paid to heat the outside. It's as simple as that. Might as well leave the door to your house wide open. It's the same thing. And so if you can guide that heat where you want it to go, you can use what heat is capable of doing. Anytime you heat a gas, it expands. So you know that. Now you've got something that you can use, you can work with. It's a mechanical force that once you heat something, the atmosphere around it will expand. Cold will contract. It's all basic science. None of this is rocket science. None of this is science fiction, it's all science fact. And so a properly engineered design that was specifically designed to run on water. To run on water in the sense that we know that if we heat water, we can get an expansion. We can get a vaporization of water. We can heat water to the extent, even though water is the most stable molecule, we can heat water to the extent that it will expand 1600 times its own volume under the right conditions. And so the energy input that we use in order to do this process, to turn it into steam, is the portion where you lose the people who say that this isn't possible. How many ever amps it takes, or watts, or whatever. But what I have learned through my quest of searching for alternative energy is that under the right conditions and the right frequency, you don't need a lot of wattage in order to generate heat. I can't remember the actual temperature, but paper will burn at something around about 300 or 400 degrees. I can't remember the actual deal right off the moment. But that means paper will burn at that point. And at the heart of that burn is about 1500 degrees Fahrenheit, and at the outer edges of that burn anywhere from 600 to 800 degrees. Which is more than enough to boil water. When you use high voltage, high frequency, and anybody who's ever run a Tesla coil will tell you that you don't want to go over and touch the spark gap after you've been running a high frequency through there, because that high frequency is basically doing the same thing as resistance would have done in normal tungsten element light bulb. It's vibrating that tungsten at such a rapid rate that it's producing friction, which in turn is producing heat, which in turn is producing light, and so on. So the same process could be acquired. When my buddy Raymond was out here, I took a 12 volt light bulb that has an element inside there that was burnt out. And I proved to him that the light bulb was burnt out. I showed him, look, you hook it to the battery, it won't light up. But then watch this. I hooked a 20,000 volt oil burner igniter, which is at a high frequency, high voltage range, and the same battery and was able to literally light up a light bulb that was dead. Raymond, are you there? You might have to unmute your microphone if you are.
Yeah, I'm here. I had a mic. I'm trying to do some paperwork and listen to you at the same time. You have a really, really good topic here.
Do you remember that story when I showed you the light bulb?
I worked on it for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I had I took and ran some really small 1/16 aircraft cable from my house to my, from my office to my house, and then also another one from my office to my shop. I had 15 T8 fluorescent light, 4 foot fluorescent light bulbs, and lit all of them up. The ironic part that I really couldn't understand, I told you what was happening, and you couldn't even explain it to where I could understand. That one bulb took, for example, 23 watts. But if you took two in series, they took 18 watts per bulb. In other words, it took more watts total, but it took fewer watts per bulb. And I actually, the 15 lights together total was burning 40-some watts. Per bulb was less than 4 watts per bulb.
Well,
now, somebody explain that one to me. But yet, I took my lumens meter, and each bulb was giving off the same number of lumens. So you multiply the wattage by 3.7, I believe it was, somewhere in that neighborhood. But the lumens... Come on, man. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, and what I tried to explain to some folks about microwave, just the microwave in general, the actual wave itself, is that when a microwave comes out of the magnetron and goes through and starts to cook your food inside there, at some point, because that wave is slamming into everything, it's no longer moving at the same speed or the same frequency, and eventually slows down and is no longer classified a microwave. The average microwave oven, I've had some that I have ran while they were completely out of the inside of the microwave. People say, oh, you're crazy, you're gonna fry yourself. And I measured different distance. Of course, I always stayed away because I had heard that, you know, microwaves weren't safe and you don't want to be too close. So I'm literally hiding behind my workbench while I'm running the first few tests. And then the more I ran it, the closer I got to it because I knew that it wasn't causing me any ill effects. But what I determined by the time it was all said and done is that if you had the glass of water right directly in front of it, you get the best amount of heat out of it. If you move it a little farther away, it takes a little longer to basically heat the water up. And then yet even farther, it takes yet even longer. And then eventually you get it to the point where if it's about a foot or so away from the end of that magnetron, then it will not even get hot. So that told me that the microwave itself wasn't making it past a foot or two maximum. The wave energy probably continued on to infinity, but nonetheless, it's not a microwave in the sense that we know microwaves anymore, because it's been interacting with atmosphere and whatever else, magnetic fields around or anything. Basically, imagine yourself running into the wind. And at a certain point, you get so tired because of the force you're trying to get against is still coming at you, and you start to slow down. That is the same thing that is occurring with a magnetic wave being sent out in a pulse, such as out of the magnetron. And so, with that said, if you understand how magnetic waves move through the air, and you understand how heat is transferred through anything, any interaction between electrons, if you understand how electron flow goes according to what the book is teaching, then you know anytime you disrupt those electrons that you're going to create a current flow. You're going to create the power. So none of what I'm saying is science fiction. It's all based on science fact. So you got to a certain point where you couldn't light any more bulbs. Because by the time that frequency made it all the way through the bulbs, it slowed down to where it's no longer the same frequency range. Did I explain that right to you?
Yeah.
So that wave can only travel so far under certain circumstances. It's actually going through a lot of process in order to try to get all the way down to the last bulb. And when you finally get to the one after that, it's no longer moving as fast as it was. Excuse me. It's done slammed into everything in a way. So knowing all this, now we know that we can actually use that bit of knowledge to know where our peak efficiency is, where the best results. It might have been better taking one bulb off, or it might have been better to leave one bulb that isn't on but it's still connected to the system for some sort of buffer zone. Those are experiments that need to be done and mathematics to be calculated up to literally find the perfect amount. But with that said, that means that if you have a whole shop full of lights that you want to run, and right now you're basically using an inefficient system to run these lights, but you know a different method by which you can run them lights on less, and maybe you got to have two of the same type of system, one on one side of the room and one on the other side of the room, and the two frequencies meet in the middle to give you your best performance, then nonetheless, now you have taken your lighting to its maximum efficiency regarding the particular lights that you are using in order to be able to have lights in your shop. Does that make sense? Raymond, you there?
Makes a lot of sense. I had to move, mute my mic because of my squeaky chair.
Oh.
I am here.
Excuse me, I don't know why I got...
And you're right.
I got a cough going on. Anyway, so I don't want to spend the rest of my life arguing with people out there trying to give them a bit of knowledge. I'm hoping that people will listen to some of these podcasts and look at their projects in a little bit different manner than what they do. And before you criticize anybody, before you give up on a project, at least try it. Find a logical reason why this isn't going to work for you or anybody else for that matter. Because even in that process, you're going to learn something, even while you're out there debunking. You know, I didn't get the results that he got, but what I did is this one little cool anomaly off to the side here that I think maybe you could actually work with if you want to try. That's how mad science works. You try it before you deny it, you test it and measure it and all that kind of stuff, and you put the information out there so that the next guy in line will see it, maybe save themselves a little bit of time, and in the same process maybe be able to add their piece of the puzzle to that and find that holy grail of electricity. Now, the guy that did...
Wait a minute, you just said something very important to me.
Yeah.
Even if you make a mistake, in other words, you try something and it doesn't work, but you made a video of it, and okay, it didn't work, so you don't put the video on YouTube. No. Exactly what you said, Shiz, is if you try something and it doesn't work the way you think it should, put the video on YouTube anyway. Just think, you might save somebody the trouble, because great minds do think alike. So just because you have the idea doesn't mean that somebody else can't come up with the same idea, and you will save somebody a lot of headache. Again, if you put on something that the way you did it, it didn't work, it may jog somebody's mind to where they will say, okay, well, they tried that. Well, how about we change this and change that? And that's how things go. It's got networking. It's bouncing ideas off of each other. But if you do an experiment, you have an idea of your own, and it doesn't work, put it on YouTube. Explain it the best way you can about what you thought it would do, but it didn't. It did this over here instead. And then that could possibly jog somebody's mind to where they'll try it in a different way. And they, if it's worked, great. Put it on YouTube. If it doesn't work, okay, fine. But still, put it on YouTube. Try to explain that it didn't work exactly like you wanted it to. My brother has chastised me several times because I put videos on that didn't work. But I tried to explain why it didn't work. I didn't do this right, or I didn't do that right, or maybe the idea was a goofball idea to start with. I don't know. But put it on YouTube, well, even if it fails. It will help. I'm sorry.
There was a man out there named Don Smith that basically was doing some resonant stuff where he was basically getting what they classified as over unity by the way that he used the coiling system to basically be adjustable and be able to tune in to frequencies of the earth, such as the magnetic field that surrounds us at all times. Now, when you talk about basically building a generator that will utilize the earth's magnetic field, then you'll get all kinds of debate on why this isn't possible or couldn't be possible or whatever, but nonetheless the earth is pulsing every time there's even so much as a vibration on the earth. The magnetic field will fluctuate, and if you look at NASA, what NASA shows, that every time a coronal discharge comes off of the sun, that it literally snaps our stretches our magnetosphere out into space, and then it snaps back and creates a pulse of energy. That's why they say that solar flares are so dangerous, because that flash it's stretching out and then snapping back like a rubber band sends a whole lot of energy down through existing power lines and stuff like that, and basically overloads the systems with too much energy, because anytime you interact with electrons, you get a response. And so with that said, Don Smith, the way that he explains his system and how it functions is simple design and gets the resonance, and then you have another guy that came out there to literally debunk what Don Smith is probably doing, trying to do or whatever. A man named Jared, who's a brilliant, says he's an electronics engineer or whatever, basically comes out and explains why it is that Don's terminology or his math or his design doesn't function. It won't work. And apparently, I guess Don Smith isn't alive anymore. I don't know what went on there, but nonetheless, his design...
I'm picking on Don Smith or anybody else that does this so-called debunking experiment, but I have seen a lot of videos where somebody does something and it works, somebody else tries to replicate it and it doesn't, and they call it debunked. But if you study their videos, you'll see they did not do it exactly the way the man did it, that it did work.
Yeah, and that's the key, because it could be something as simple as the atmosphere within the room made the difference in the dielectric or the capacitance. The atmosphere could be thick or thin, or, you know.
There we go. The two-stage oscillator that I started my videos on years ago. Mine worked. Well, I rebuilt the daggone thing in the shop so I could operate it in the wintertime, but I built it out of wood rather than steel. And it was sitting on a wood floor rather than concrete. And it worked. But then, all of a sudden, it stopped working. And then, it worked again. Well, come to find out, like you said, atmosphere in the room. Duh, wood. Temperature and moisture affect the wood.
Yeah.
It was bending and twisting. And the two-stage oscillator, the bigger you build it, the less it takes to be out of plumb and out of level for it not to work properly.
Yep.
It'll still work. It just will not work properly. I mean, even myself building the thing, I messed up. So I tried to replicate what I did that worked, in the shop, but I didn't do it exactly the same. I didn't put it on a concrete foundation, a large concrete foundation that wouldn't move, and I didn't get it, built it out of the raw material, built it out of wood, which one day we would have 80% humidity and say 65 degrees. The next day it would be 40% humidity and 70 degrees or 90 degrees. I mean, I live in Texas. We can have a 30, 40 degrees difference in 12 hours of temperature. So to build it out of wood is wrong. Even I, built replicating my own invention, messed up. So just because you build something that see somebody else doing it and it works for them, and you build it, it doesn't work for you, then you need to check your build. Did you build it exactly the same? Did I make my point?
Yeah, that's the, you know, that's the whole thing, you know. That's why I don't give up on, you know, even the failed designs out there like you were talking about, because in all of those, according to science, for every action is an equal and opposite reaction.
Exactly.
And so, you know, with that said, we know that if something occurs, then we're going to get something out the other side, whether it be waste heat or actual usable force or whatever. So common sense and basic science and basic physics, if you take all that stuff in together and you pay attention to all these different things and what they're doing, that's why I say I know that this engine that I talk about will function exactly the way that I say it will. Because it's based off of already existing technology and my understanding of that existing technology. I understand how a steam engine works. I understand how pressure works. I understand how heat works. And so, with that knowledge, we could engineer literally a perfect engine. And if you engineer it specifically to run off of water, you know, diesel fuel basically set to run off of diesel fuel. Diesel engine, is what I was trying to say, is designed to run off a diesel engine. And you know, actually, the one guy that pretty much knocked down the idea of running on water, well, there's been lots of people that did that, but one in specific here recently also did a video about combustion and argued the difference between a burn and an explosion.
You know, we discussed the operation of a diesel engine at some length here 1 or 2 weeks back.
Yeah.
And I brought up the idea or concept that a diesel engine will burn off of any, it'll run off of any combustible liquid or solid dry substance. I mean, a diesel engine originally, its original concept and original way it was run was off of coal dust. Well, that means it would run off of dried leaves, powdered up. It would run off of dried cut grass out of your yard.
Yeah,
it was off of trashy newspapers that are thrown away.
So essentially,
no, grind them up into a powder. Run your diesel engine to turn your generator.
So essentially, the fuel that you get, you can get free fuel just about everywhere. It doesn't matter. Any carbon-based thing out there can burn.
Anything that can burn will run a diesel engine.
And you know that. You know, when you burn stuff, you're going to get a byproduct, which is heat, all right, and light. And so, you know, utilizing that, there's no reason why you couldn't take everything that you already know and put it in the right order, re-engineer how an engine works, or even an air compressor for that matter. You know, there's a really high dollar air compressor out there. I don't remember what the actual name of it is. I just heard it yesterday and I can't remember now. But your modern air compressor head basically uses a piston that goes up and down and produces pressure. On the downstroke of that, it's actually producing a vacuum, which basically is counteracting your pressure. And so they designed a specific type of generator that was like a positive displacement pump that would keep the air pressure always flowing in the same direction and never produce a vacuum on the back end. basically, if you could visualize like how a positive displacement pumps, if you got two gears that are interlocked and the fluid is coming from behind these gears, when the fluid gets to the other side, it can't go back the other direction in any way. And so you can use this knowledge for like hydraulics or whatever, you know, you use that knowledge of a positive displacement for pressure. And it's really crazy that it really don't take a whole lot of input to, like, let's say your average 2-ton jack that you use to raise your car up. There ain't no way you can go out there with your bare hands and just lift it up unless you're Superman. But you can take this jack and you can put it underneath there just by cranking the little handle up, which doesn't really take much effort at all. You use basically a positive displacement to push the fuel, the fluid inside there, and pressurize it, causing the pressure, the energy has to go somewhere. And so it takes the path of least resistance, which is raising your car up off the ground. And that sounds crazy. That's the path of least resistance.
I just had to giggle. When you said you lift your car up off the ground yourself.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, I had a car, had real small wheels on it. I was driving along, and there was this mud puddle. Not mud puddle, just a hole in the road. And I didn't think about nothing of it because the water was level. You know, I'm thinking, what the heck, a little spot of water. And I drove across it, and all of a sudden my wheel dropped down in the hole, and I couldn't get out. So I just opened the door of the car, walked around to the front of the car, grabbed the fender, picked it up, and moved it over to the side. So you just called me Superman.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Now, when I was in high school, I used to lift weights, and I was pretty daggone strong, but I did pick up the front end of my automobile and sidestep two steps to get with the wheel out of the hole so I could roll down the road.
But as crazy as that might sound, you had multiple things working for you.
Now, I don't want anybody to think that I might possibly be a liar. Because the car was an Isetta 300.
Well, even at that, you still
had... That's a pretty car that had two wheels in the back, 16 inches apart, and two wheels in the front, 4.5 feet apart.
You still had some things working to your advantage, such as leverage and the fact that the tire was down in the hole that was full of water.
Right.
So the water pressure pushing up on the tire helped you out. The leverage and the weight of the vehicle, because the majority of it's outside of the hole, allowed you to be able to use leverage and hydraulics in order to literally lift something that you probably could have lifted by yourself. Even if none of that, but made it a lot easier in order to do so because of the circumstance.
The main factor was the fact that the entire car full of gasoline with no one in it weighed less than 600 pounds. And I was only picking up the front half, which the motor was in the back.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the thing is, I did it.
Yeah,
I did what you said. I was Superman. I picked my car up and booted it out of a hole. But I have to tell the truth. And the truth is, there were other factors involved.
Yeah.
You know? Okay.
But nonetheless, nonetheless, you still was able to do it using physics and science and, you know, basic knowledge and some brute strength. So, that's my point.
Right.
By utilizing everything that we know and invoking the laws of physics in a manner in which it's going to benefit us and be the most efficient, then you could literally guide the temperature to where you want it to go, as opposed to just allowing it to go where it wants to go. If you designed an engine properly, you wouldn't even need a radiator on that car.
Right.
And so taking away the radiator, then now that's one extra system that you don't have to worry about failing.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. Been there, done that, wore that t-shirt, fit like a glove.
Yep, when we go back and we talk about the old pop-pop boat, and I know that, you know, I'm really disappointed that we never did get the doggone contest off the ground. Not one single person entered a boat in that contest, so it just basically was a waste of time as far as trying to get people motivated. But, nonetheless, the physics is still the same. You're able to put a little candle underneath a little boiler and you get this thing to move around. And you know that anything that can be made on one scale can be scaled up or scaled down. So, Stephen Gibbons typed in the chat room, Don Smith device using the spark gap to pull in energy from the surrounding atmosphere, which Tesla discovered when he was turning his experiment on and off with the throw switch, he noticed that if he switched it on and off quickly, it would overload its device. The collapsing electromagnetic field would draw in energy from the surrounding atmosphere. And that's what I was talking about, how you could actually feel an ionic wind build up right before, like we're using the Van de Graaff generator to charge a capacitor, right before that electricity jumped across that gap, you could literally feel air pressure around that spark gap area where you got a cool ionic wind that's coming in from outside and adding to that force. And so you literally get audible sound when that snaps across there, a pressure wave. Voltage is pressure, and that's what does the work. And so when I say that I don't care about current watts and amps, it doesn't mean that I don't care about how the standard system functions and what it requires to run it. It's that I know that what I am talking about is literally moving energy rapidly enough to charge supercapacitors or whatever, that in turn you can slow that energy back down, because now you have a large volume of it. See, if you look on air compressors or pneumatic, like I got in my hand a quarter inch air die grinder, it's pneumatic. It says it takes 4.5 cubic feet per minute at 90 psi to run this at its maximum potential. So that means I got to have 4.5 cubic feet of air pressure constant to be able to run this deal. And so if I'm running it and the air pressure in the tank falls down to 4.5 cubic feet, then that means this thing's going to slow down and the air compressor will kick back on and pump it back up to pressure again. Now, the positive displacement pump that I talked about, this high-dollar air compressor out there, doesn't require a tank because of the way that it actually keeps the force pressure through to constant run air tools with. So it's just a matter of engineering. How you engineered that air compressor to begin with is how you're moving that energy from one point to the next. So if you have a perfectly designed air compressor that doesn't require a tank, that means you can fit it into a smaller container like a car or something like that in order to be able to run it. And using gear ratios...
You said 4.5 cubic feet. What's the time period?
Well, it has to be 4.5 cubic per minute.
Oh, per minute, okay.
Yeah.
Without a time factor, it means nothing.
Yeah, that's what
it means. Everything.
That's what CFM means, cubic feet per minute.
Okay, right.
Yeah, and so...
So you're talking just a little under 70 PSI. Now, what volume? I mean, the volume, yes.
4.5 cubic feet per minute at 90 PSI will run this air tool. So if you...
If you had a wide open hose, what diameter would it have to be to release that much air in that period of time?
Well, I don't know. That's where the math would have to come in. But if you built a compressor that was able to continuously push out 4.5 cubic feet per minute's worth of air at 90 PSI, you'd be able to run this tool continuously. So if you design an air compressor that ran on electric motor, basically... The design I got in my head was you take a spinning wheel that has like cups on each end of it, and input ports where as this cup's coming by, it can literally create a vacuum and suck in air pressure and then force that around, and then the next one does the same thing, and you constantly keep a constant flow of 90 PSI coming out a short hose into your device. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, you're not talking a very big compressor here.
No.
And you're talking about off the shelf, plug and play. You go to Home Depot and buy that going air compressor today for less than $700. That will do exactly that.
Well,
you will get 70 PSI on a wide open 1/8 inch line and produce over 4.5 cubic feet per minute.
if you look at what is actually occurring inside of these things right here, then you can learn how to design your compressor accordingly. And
you don't have to design the compressor. That's my point. You don't have to design the compressor. It already exists.
Well,
maybe. Just buy one and plug it in. That's it. Well, I mean, you know, we said several times, we have the answers to all the problems of the world.
Yep.
They already exist. It's just that people aren't putting them together in the right order. The air compressor is already designed. It's already out there.
Well, so basically taking all these pieces of the puzzle, putting them in together and such, you know, you can get a perfectly efficient running engine.
Yes.
And if you take and utilize what you learned from that engine, you could get electrical appliances to do the exact same thing. You can engineer them to be like, you don't have to run your refrigerator, your freezers on 120 volts AC or 220 volts AC. You could actually run them on a whole lot less. You could run them on 12 volts. You just have to engineer the actual compressor that's inside that, or replace the compressor that's inside that to, you know, a different design. With that said, if you had a same size refrigerator you got right now that would run on 12 volts as opposed to 120 volts AC, then to me that is getting the better efficiency out of it. And I honestly believe that you could actually do it with less, knowing how those compressors are basically compressing gas, and then the gas goes into an expansion chamber, which, because of the physics of the whole deal, will create a heat exchange, and that instant flash back into no longer a gas, basically has a cooling effect, which cools down the core that basically you see that makes your ice inside your refrigerator. Am I misquoting that anyway there, Raymond?
You said exactly right.
Alright, well, Steven said from the transistor video above, it was noticed that the power gain was a factor of 18 or greater. So, in the Overunity community, I believe you can actually get out more than you put in, under the right conditions. But in the free energy community, which is what I'm talking about here, I'm looking for first, efficiency. Because if you can run a generator on a gallon of gas as opposed to 10 gallons of gas per day, then to me that's a benefit to humanity as far as now financially you can afford to run that generator. And there's all kinds of technology out there, from wood gasifiers to, you know, the GEET design for the GEET reactor, or the, there was one other one I was going to throw in there for an example. I hate it when that happens. But there's all kinds of different designs out there. Oh, the vaporization carburetor. Did I mention that one yet?
No, not yet.
All right, well, you vaporize gas, and you don't need near as much gas. Proof of that is the engine that they call the flame licker, which essentially has a butane or propane or even methane, for that matter, whatever, flame outside of the engine. And the intake portion basically sucks the gas off of that flame and burns in the combustion chamber running the engine. So where I wouldn't want a fire on the outside of my engine, it still proves the concept that vaporization works. It really works. And so, you know, there's another bit of science for you. Now, we bring all this stuff to the table here of mad science because we want people to actually get out there and do some research and try things out and come back with their findings and help each other out to literally figure out ways by which we can take things off the store shelves that are readily available for everybody and make things so much more efficient than what they were to begin with. And if you can accomplish that, then people will have more money available to them to literally, you know, reinvest in more different designs. There is some sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, a conspiracy or resistance or whatever out there in this world to literally fight as hard as possible against guys like me and Raymond. Because we say things, and, you know, the things that we say basically boil down to, at some point in the game, taking money out of somebody's wallet. You know? And Sue, I don't know, you want to add Barry into the call there?
Sure, why not?
Okay, let me see if I can find him there.
Finally got out of bed. He's wandering around here. He'll probably get on here in a little bit.
All right, I'll just add him to the call, and we'll take it from there. So anyway, I feel like sometimes I get aggravated. I feel like I'm beating a dead horse because I feel like that the world isn't listening. And when hi Barry, you're alive. And when that happens,
barely alive.
Yeah, I know. I'm feeling kind of under it today too. So.
Well, I just crawled out of bed. It's about 2 minutes ago.
But I do have my coffee. And so we're talking about efficiency today.
You and Thomas are playing Flynn today. He just crawled out of bed and feels like that too.
Anyway, we've been doing these radio shows for quite some time, and we keep on putting information out there for people, hoping that people will run with it and try to resolve issues that are necessary to resolve out there. I see a future in both directions, one of which basically we go over the falls in a barrel and hope for the best when we crash at the bottom where the rocks are. Or we not get in the barrel to begin with, and we utilize that doggone waterfall in a efficient manner to generate power or do something to help nature out, do what nature does, and work in harmony with nature. Those hydroelectric dams, it's been around since way back during Tesla's time, and they still work. They still put power out there. We've had some upgrades to them over time, but, you know, upgrades and repairs and better ones put in and that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, there's still some that were that old that are literally in service today. So we actually have the capability to make things that last for a while. The main energy industries out there, you think they're going to buy a generator if they don't think that thing is going to hold up very long, and then a week or two down the line, they got to buy another one, and then another one a little bit longer after that? No, they want something that's going to be sturdy.
I've been sitting here thinking about a paint cup gun and your little airbrushes.
Yeah.
They work off the venturi effect.
Yeah.
Couldn't you grind up old wheat straw or hay, dried corn stalk, grind them up to a powder to the form that you could actually use a venturi?
Yeah.
And some type of a little motor that would stir the powder up so that it would float in the air in your cup. And then as your intake, when your piston going down, would actually suck the air in along with the powder. Then well, come up and compress it, and your spark plug go off, and fire your engine, and run your engine off dry fuel.
Why
would that work?
I took a little 12-volt air compressor, slightly modified it, and basically took a Dremel and notched an exhaust port out at the... When the piston was all the way down as far as it could go, I notched it just right above the piston so that when the piston goes up and comes down, it can exhaust out the side of the deal. I plugged right off the other ones, and I put a pyrometer in the hose on the output side of where the air pressure usually went out. And I ran that thing using a 12-volt battery, and the compression was enough that I could literally bring the cylinder inside that up to over 250 degrees. Now that's past the boiling point.
Right.
212 degrees Fahrenheit is boiling point. And so anything below, anything after that, you start to get superheated steam. And so with that said, that was just a little modification to an already existing piece of equipment. Now, if you properly engineer an engine from start to finish to have a long stroke like a diesel, so that you get a long compression stroke that allows the time to build up more pressure and more heat, by the time it gets all the way to top dead center, you've got a pocket of highly compressed hot fuel that's ready to do its thing. You see what I'm saying?
See exactly what you're saying.
So in the world of energy generation, basically what I'm trying to show everybody out there, it's not free energy in the sense like old Keshi's voodoo version of plasma, where you gotta love the reactor because if you act like a jerk, there's no free electricity for you. It is simple physics, simple science, with existing technology that literally utilizes all the forces of nature and the laws of physics to the advantage that you are now running this engine with its utmost efficiency, which means it takes less fuel than you used before because there's no waste involved in this specific engine design. If you was going to call it anything, you could call it a focused heat engine, or you could call it an electric steam engine, whatever the case may be. But if you're an engineer or mechanic out there and you got to take the time to go out there and discourage people by making videos that says bollocks on it, that says basically you can't run your car off of water, then you, number one, haven't paid attention to what it is that I'm saying, because you're not understanding that I'm not trying to run it off of hydrogen per se. I'm not trying to produce an electrolysis process that is going to separate the hydrogen and oxygen and burn it like you're explaining. What I'm talking about is using the physics of the pressure and the heat to literally get the same exact result that you would get in a hydrogen explosion in a nuclear power plant under the wrong conditions. If it can be done on a large scale, it can be done on a small scale. There's more than one way to heat water. There's many ways to heat water.
Hey, remember the time I told you about when I put... Well, you know, okay, water is roughly 1 pound per gallon, right? I mean, 8 pounds per gallon. And there's 8 pints in the gallon. So I took 1 pint or 1 pound of water, put it in my blender at 42 degrees, turned my blender on puree, and 20 minutes later it was 92 degrees. It raised the temperature 50 degrees in 20 minutes.
Yep.
Now, I had no insulation on the container with the water in it, and the motor itself was giving off heat. So I'm thinking, if I used distilled water, which will not conduct electricity, I could actually submerge the motor in the water, insulate the container holding the water, and probably raise the temperature of that water up in 5 or 10 minutes, raise it 50 degrees.
Yeah, you could do it.
Because they were doing a lot of waste there. The heat that was being generated by the friction of spinning the water. Duh.
Not to mention the fact that that motor, that electric motor, would last so much longer as opposed to the normal way that you run that motor outside in the air, because when you're running an electric motor out in the air, you're meeting resistance whether you realize it or not. Even with the atmosphere alone, the atmosphere is going to create a drag and resistance because you're basically cutting through it.
Right.
And so that drag and resistance equals to friction, equals to heat, equals to losses. And so if you design it the way that you're talking about, where you actually run it in distilled water, and you can ensure this as a closed loop system so that there's no chance of impurities actually making it into that water to make it conductive, then you'd have the perfect scenario for the perfect engine, because even the carbon brushes on there under that those conditions wouldn't shave themselves off because they wouldn't be reaching the amount of friction necessary to start cutting into that material. It's lubricated. You see what I'm saying? You could have it underwater, and it would still run and wouldn't short itself out. So there are possibilities, and that's why I'm trying to get people to network. That's why I'm trying to build the dream team and take what I'm seeing in my head and convey it to somebody who can literally put it together. If there ever comes a day that the machine that is inside of my head is ever put into action and is built, then this world will be truly amazed, and not just that thought alone, but the world in general of what could actually be accomplished. I don't see the world the same way that everyone else sees the world. Each one of us is our individuals. And for whatever reasons and the circumstances that led up to this actual conversation that we're having right now, I see the world mechanically. In everything that I talk about, whether it be electricity or any engine out there or life in general or how nature functions and the forces that are available for making, you know, tools that we utilize to basically live in comfort. And so I try to convey these ideas to people in a manner in which they can understand it. I mean, if you can't explain it simple, I can't remember who the man was that said it, but if you can't explain it simple that somebody can understand it, then you don't understand it. And I think I've been pretty good at explaining it simple. So I think I understand what I'm talking about. Is it working?
Thomas just said under his breath he thinks it was Einstein that said that quote that you just gave.
Cool. See, and I like Einstein because he got nice hair.
Explain it in such a manner that other people can understand, then you don't understand it.
Well, I think I've done a pretty good job of explaining what I'm trying to point out to the world. Look, folks, if we really got problems like we said, and I said this on other people's networks and other people's radio shows and stuff, if we really honestly have the problems that we've got worldwide, then you really ought to be paying attention to guys like me. I'm not looking for attention or fame or fortune or anything like that. I'm just actually trying to do some good and find some solutions and get those solutions on the table so that everybody knows that the options are available to them to literally resolve the issues that we have before us. If I wanted to be rich, I would be rich. Because I understand how this world works. I'm not willing to basically sell my soul to the devil, so to speak, to, you know, elevate myself up to a financial status higher than the average Joe out there. But I can't take none of that with me when I go. And I don't even know how much time I'll even be around as far as that goes. But I don't want to waste the rest of my life or potential afterlife or whatever on ridiculousness. I'm telling the world that we have every single answer to every single question, and if you're paying attention to what people are saying and what they're doing, you'll figure that out yourself. But the boat ride that we're on, we're in the barrel, we're getting ready to go over the falls, and you got one guy saying, maybe now's the time to start paddling towards the shore. If you're not listening to him, you're going to go over the falls in the barrel. And then once you're on your way down, it's just a matter of brace for impact and hope for the best when you get to the bottom. And so if we got all these disasters going on out there, now's the time to bring the brilliant minds to the table. Now's the time to, you know, get involved and bring about a resolution to literally start steering this boat towards the shore. There's a huge disaster that has been going on for 6 years over there, Fukushima radiation and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not trying to be rude to anybody. I'm not trying to be disrespectful to anybody. But there are people in the communities out there that are panicking over things that don't need to be panicked at and ignoring things, possibilities that can resolve this issue. It is almost as if some folks love to be or need to be in danger mode at all times. If I honestly believed that the sky was falling, I would be the first one out there shouting, "The sky is falling." But if I see that there is a resolution using existing technology to get this disaster under control, and I'm sitting here asking the tough question is, okay, so I understand that we got this technology that we can literally drill through the ground sideways underneath the earth, and then we can inject in the general vicinity of where this material is having this particular reaction that will at the very least reduce the reaction just like it did when it was actually in function. In the actual reactor itself, it had control rods that controlled the, it would grab up the radioactive isotopes as they were being depleted from the hot radioactive rods. And so that basically slowed down or sped up the process of boiling the water into steam that in turn used to turn the turbines to produce the electricity that everybody used. And so if we can drill sideways in the ground, you don't have to send a robot up to the deal that is going to basically, once it gets there, the temperature of the radioactive process is occurring, is causing the processors inside the robot's brain to basically melt and desolder the parts from the board and short itself out and die right there because it's not built for that type of temperature. Instead of doing that, you use a mechanical device that doesn't require any kind of circuitry in it to literally tunnel up into where the reaction is occurring under the ground and inject the proper materials in order to slow that reaction down to bring it down to a operating temperature close enough that now you can go for step two to literally try to contain this. With the same hole that you just drilled, you can also inject liquid nitrogen up inside there, and everybody knows that when you cool something down, the atomic structure, the atoms, and the way that it all functions slows down because when you cool something, it contracts, it gets tighter. And so we can inject something in there to slow the process down of releasing the energy to grab up those radioactive isotopes, while right after that we send in a cooling agent such as liquid nitrogen that will literally start to freeze those molecules down to a stable mass, whatever. And at that point, when you get it to that point, you should be able to notice with your Geiger counters that the radiation hasn't stopped, but it slowed down drastically. It slowed down drastically enough to where now you can get just a hair bit closer to it for the next deal in line, which is containment. You could take backhoes or track hoes that can reach out for a huge distance, and you can literally dig a moat around that entire facility. You can literally inject concrete up underneath the mass itself. And they have concrete these days that will set up in less than a few minutes. It's called dry lock. And you use it for whenever you're working on something that's cracked and is still wet, and you wouldn't normally use this particular concrete on this because it wouldn't set up. But dry lock, if you dump it down your drain is plugged until you can get a jackhammer down there and pry this stuff out, because it basically sets up harder than concrete. And it is concrete. So there are processes by which we could actually contain that problem that we could have utilized over 6 years ago when this very first became an issue. And so when I'm trying to explain people to them that there are a couple different terminologies and there's a couple different processes going on here, that if you understand them, you'll know at what stage of danger that you're actually in, such as when Galen Windsor talked about radioactivity not being dangerous, he wasn't lying. What the process that they had missed in this deal was that Galen Windsor was talking about, you can't hold this in your hand because it will burn you, because it is depleting and it's releasing this radiation that's going on. And in that process, because of the how hot that material is, you are literally having radioactive isotopes being released that are slamming into other molecules that are producing gamma waves, gamma radiation. That's where the danger zone changes. The gamma radiation basically is the part that goes and knocks off the little pieces of your DNA and causes mutations in cells.
That's where the Hulk came from, isn't it?
Probably. But
he was hit by gamma radiation.
Nonetheless, if you understand the process, you can protect yourself from those gamma rays. You can protect yourself from the radiation. It's radioactive contamination that you have the problem with, and that's when some of this material gets scattered all over the place, and now you've got hot spots everywhere, and you don't want to ingest this into your body because now it's going to cause you some serious issues, whether it's in your lungs or your liver or whatever. But by understanding how this functions, you'll know where you can go and where you can't go. You'll know what the potential of spreading this is. So when radioactive water is being pumped up into the ocean, you already know that it's hot because of the radioactivity, but it's not contaminated to the extent, unless it's actually pulling off little particles of the radioactive, highly refined radioactive rods and dispersing them everywhere out into the environment. What you have from the where the water cooled is really hot water that basically just came out of a microwave. Now that hot water basically goes into the ocean, interacts with the temperature difference in the ocean, which could literally cause the, because of the temperature difference, cause weather to occur under the ocean. And to a great extent can literally cause the Gulf Stream, which is the clockworks of the ocean itself that basically moves cold water and all the materials from one part of the earth to the next. And during that interaction, if you can literally move the jets or the Gulf Stream over, that would create a temperature difference all the way down the line, which would change the weather all the way down the line, which would literally cause an effect on the jet stream that is up in the atmosphere. And so when that happens, you're going to notice crazy weather all over the place. Places melting off that shouldn't melt off, and places getting cold that shouldn't be getting cold. Because you just basically made a mess of what nature is trying to do. So instead of taking this water and pumping it through and then trying to store it in there, and in the process somehow or another losing some of this water out to the ocean, you could take the same amount of water and you can run it through there, cool it down, use a heat exchange system to literally take away the heat from the water, and then recirculate that same exact water over and over and over again, just like you do in an automobile through your radiator system. And so there's no need to be storing up thousands and thousands of gallons of radioactive water. There's no purpose in it. The only reason why it's even in storage is in case particles of the rods themselves made it into that water. Because water is the most stable molecule on the earth. It doesn't like to be separated. It doesn't like company. And so if as long as this water hasn't got to the point where you literally used heat to basically get the dang molecules inside there dancing around until they produce friction, which in turn produces yet even more heat, then a water molecule can be used to literally put out a fire. You see what I'm saying? And so, knowing all this, and knowing about heat exchange, had they, right from the start of this whole process, used all these physics, they could have contained the mess without it ever even making it to the ocean. They could have recirculated, and they can still do this to this very day. They can still recirculate the same water and filter that water to the extent down in all the to the microns of water molecules. Anything small, anything, any pieces of fuel rod that could have potentially get away from that fuel rod itself, that maybe broke off from deterioration or even the explosion itself, could be filtered out, and those small containers could literally then be stored in a safe manner, just like you would the depleted uranium rods that are in the cooling ponds for 6 to 10 years. So, one of two things is either going on here. Either Galen Windsor was telling the truth and the government was telling a lie, or Galen Windsor was wrong and the government is just insane. Or stupid.
Could it be possible that both of them were insane?
Well, it's possible. It's possible. But nonetheless, if you understand what I'm trying to say to you, and the problem is as big as what they say it is, if it's a potential of long-term effects, health effects such as cancer all over the place, and people are dying from cancer all over the place, and there's a resolution so readily available and so incredibly simple. We've got companies out there that have the technology and the gears and the tools to literally do exactly what I just explained. To literally start off a mile or so away from this doggone thing and drill sideways into the ground. We got mathematicians that can calculate the exact proximity of where that material should be setting. And we've got thermal imaging that can tell any temperature difference, and so the hottest spot is where the reactor is setting right now, where the material is. And so you can literally zoom in on it, drill into it, inject the same material used in the control rods to slow down the process, then inject liquid nitrogen right directly in on this process to freeze it down to negative 300 and some odd degrees Fahrenheit, and be able to slow that process down yet even further and basically make it into containment. The only thing that makes this stuff dangerous at the point that it's in right now is that you could take a can of pork and beans or a can of anything. It don't matter. Your favorite soup. Let's just say your favorite soup. You got some Campbell's soup. Put that Campbell's soup in your burn pile and allow the fire to heat that can up. The energy produced inside that can is so incredible that it will literally explode that can. The heat being released by this radioactive material would do the equivalence, because it's going to continue to get hotter until it reaches its maximum amount of heat potential that it's capable of. It only has so much energy in there. When you find the level of its maximum, you can build a container that will be able to hold this stuff, even in its molten state, if that's the case that it's in right now. The mathematics are there, the science are there. But when you try to tell people, when you try to talk to people about this, and their understanding is only what the book says, and I say, hear Galen Windsor out, just listen to what he has to say. So that way you got his side of the story, you got the government side of the story, you got my side of the story, and everybody else's side of the story, and you can put all these facts on the table and you can come to a common sense conclusion of what needs to be done in order to resolve this situation before it kills off the planet. either it's not as bad of a problem as it's being portrayed, or it's worse than that, and the government ain't telling nobody about it, but nonetheless, it's all of our necks on the line, including the government officials out there. Their necks are on the line as well. Their future generations are on the line as well. They told us these things would last for thousands of years after, you know, it's all said and done. They got to set in a cooling pond for 6 to 10 years after they're depleted to the extent where they can't no longer boil the water as efficient as needed to produce enough steam to turn the turbines. And this keeps adding up, and they got to keep it in the pool for 10 years. If anything goes wrong and the water level draws down, you will end up boiling that water away into steam, which if it's in a closed-in container, will pressurize that container. The high temperature and the high pressure will cause literally a compression ignition, which will basically create a hydrogen explosion, and then you start kicking around all the materials that, you know, basically just got shook up. And so, I'm not saying that Fukushima is not a bad deal. I'm not saying that radiation is not dangerous. What I'm trying to point out is there's different stages and different terminologies that are getting combined into one misunderstanding of the entire situation that has put people into panic mode, and they will hear no part of anything you got to say. Well, this guy died of cancer, that guy died of cancer, and everybody else is dying of cancer. Well, how old was this guy when he died of cancer? Was he a smoker? Did he work around anything? Was there any other possibility why this guy could have died of cancer? I don't know. But you got to have all the facts in on the table so that you can make a common sense conclusion of what's actually occurring here. If the governments of the world ain't worried about it, then that's something I want to know why. Why aren't you worried about it? It could it be that Galen was telling the truth? Or could it be that you're just stupid and don't care? Either way, we got to get to the bottom of it, because if our food chain falls, then guess what? It's only a matter of time before that last domino tips and we go as well. We have all the technology necessary to literally build clean, renewable alternative energy devices that will work in perfect harmony with nature. That would make a lot of people out there who are environmentally friendly very happy. Wouldn't make the fuel industries very happy until they learn that they could actually make some money too by using some of the things that they already do and their maintenance crews and stuff like that to maintain a new infrastructure, and they would work there, everything would work out, and they would still make some money as well. So if it's all down to finance, we could resolve that issue along with the issue of how to make it better. The best way to start it off, as far as I'm concerned, is to make things more efficiently and to address the problems that we've got going on right now. If the British petroleum industry is out there still pumping Corexit into the water, it's having an adverse effect on the wildlife in the water. That adverse effects that are happening to those, compounded with uncontrolled release of energy into the ocean and all the other shenanigans that go on, whether you believe in chemtrailing or spraying of chemicals into the air, whatever. All of these things in conjunction with one another are creating a mess that nature is trying desperately to clean up. And when nature doesn't get what nature wants, then you're going to get some effects that you ever seen the commercial a long time ago, "It's not nice to fool Mother Nature."
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the case. And that's what we're contending with right now. We have the capabilities to clean up Fukushima. We have the capabilities to resolve the issues once and for all. We have the capabilities to literally dispose of properly or utilize the energy left in all the radioactive materials that are stored all over this planet, and do it in such a manner where it's not going to be harmful to anybody's health, and be able to resolve the issue by never using that type of energy again. as long as this energy has a place to go, it can't pressurize a container. It can't escape. And unless this is broke down, like there's a different type of ceramic used in a magnetron, a microwave magnetron. It's pink. I think the material is called beryllium or something like that. Something that you really don't want to get the dust of it in your mouth because it's really bad health effects, to the extent that I don't think you're going to make it. But nonetheless, they realized that instead of using that, they could use a different type of ceramic. So if you look in there, there's a new, in the newer ones, there's a white ceramic that's actually around the magnetron that is safe to handle. So it's all a matter of materials and learning from what you learned in the past of what needs to be done, re-engineering a few things, and being able to resolve the issues of the world before the issues of the world resolve us. It's not time to panic, folks. It's time to get busy. Panic ain't going to do nothing. If a guy's sitting here telling you there's a way to get around it, and every time you open your mouth and try to explain this way to get around it, they pick you apart. But, oh no, you can't get close to that because every robot they send in there melted down. Well, my friend, then don't send a robot. It's not the tool for the job. The robot is not designed to withstand that type of heat. So, if you think about a drilling bit that can drill sideways all the way through rock and sand and granite or whatever the heck they end up drilling through on the process, there's a lot of heat being generated. Those drill bits are designed to withstand a lot of heat. It's the tools and the proper use of the tools that's going to get the job done. So if anybody out there can translate to the Japanese, if you speak Japanese really well, you get me on the phone and you get some of the Japanese engineers on the phone and I will explain to them in graphic detail what I'm trying to explain to the world right now. We can resolve this issue. Might not be the cheapest way to do it, but it's going to be the smartest way to do it. And it's going to use every bit of technology that they already know about. So I don't know what more to say, you know. I'm not saying that I got all the answers in the world, but I'm telling you, I got enough answers to understand right now that there are resolutions out there. And there are people a lot more brilliant than me that if you bring them to the table, they'll understand what I'm saying too. But if you get anybody, I don't care who it is, anybody who thinks, well, there ain't no way you can do it, don't bring them to the table, they're just going to slow you down.
Exactly.
At this stage in the game, what do we got to lose by trying whatever we can to...
If you think you cannot, then you really and truly cannot.
Yeah.
If you think you can, then you can. It's just that simple.
Yep.
If a man truly believes that something cannot be done, then he cannot do it.
Well, I believe in hope. And I look out there and I see, as messed up as this world is, I still believe we can fix it. Honestly,
yes.
I do.
Yes, we can.
So, you know, Barry, you got your coffee yet?
I'm just getting my coffee in to be just finished brewing. I hope you're right. I hope we can fix it. But, I don't know. I think we're in a lot of trouble. And as far as Fukushima goes, we're seeing nuclear isotopes showing up in the Okanagan Valley right now from Fukushima. Only trace amounts, but I don't think it's going to get any better. And if we don't stop it, I don't see any good coming out of it in the next 5 years because the ocean is having a lot of problems right now.
Sure, and it's all the more reason why.
Well, I tell you, well, you know, just the thought that we're jeopardizing the ocean, it should shock people into reality. I mean, we don't want to talk fear, but the reality is that the ocean supports all life on the planet. And if we take the ocean out, there ain't going to be anybody left here to talk about solutions and problems in the future.
I agree.
So what do we do about that right now? That's the biggest thing. You know, what's going on with you? I know you were on with Lonnie Clark this week, Shazis, and I listened to that show quite a bit. I was in the chat room there.
Yes, good show.
Quite a bit of it. And, you know, Lonnie's committed to exposing exactly what's going on in the nuclear industries around the world. And really, if you look at it in depth right now, I think the biggest problem facing the human race is radiation. And that's going to be our biggest challenge, to dispose of it safely and shut these plants down and stop all these reactions all over the planet that are ticking time bombs.
When you say, you
know, those spent fuel rods, you know, those spent fuel rods that we talk about in Fukushima have the potential to create a hydrogen explosion that, like, we've never seen before on this planet.
Sure.
As you know that, I know that.
Sure.
But people are aware of that. And that's what we need to bring to public attention.
But potential. But when we talk about radiation, we got to be real careful about exactly what we're saying. We got radioactive. Me and Lonnie was talking after the show, and we were talking about the right terminology so that I can wrap my head around it would be radioactive contamination, and those are the isotopes that you're talking about finding in trace amounts out there in the deal. Radiation in itself isn't that big of a concern as the radioactive isotopes and the reaction that they're having with any other material that's in the general vicinity. See, radiation isn't like a disease per se. It doesn't spread to something like, you don't take this and cause this to be radioactive. It those two aren't combining. It's the reaction that's occurring between that radioactive isotope with everything else that comes around it, and the release of energy that's causing gamma rays and such to basically shoot through somebody's DNA and cause a problem. You understand what I'm saying here? That's why over here in the United States, where we're further away from that deal, that's why we're not experiencing to the extreme what they would be in the general vicinity of what's going on. Because those gamma rays, they're not going to make it all the way over here. You see what I mean? And so, containment is what you need. Containment and understanding of what's actually occurred. When that first explosion occurred, if it busted up those fuel rods and dispersed basically little chunks or microscopic pieces into the atmosphere, then that's going to come down somewhere. If the wind can carry it far enough, it'll come down over here. Those will be hot spots, and those little sections will be hot spots. You understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
It's not that I don't recognize the dangers of the material. I do understand the dangers, and I recognize that it's not a good thing and can really cause some serious health issues. But what I'm trying to do is put it in perspective so that people can understand that there are ways that we can understand how this works, be able to corral it, be able to contain it, and be able to clean the mess up. But if I just say that, you know, we're all going to die from radiation sickness, then I'm basically saying that this stuff is everywhere. We got particles on our clothes as we speak right now, and we're radiated.
You know, what I don't understand is why are we even bothering with fossil fuels such as oil, natural gas, and unnatural fuels such as uranium, I mean, or atomic fusion, or fission, or whatever the heck you want to call it. Why are we messing around with this radioactive material? There is energy everywhere.
Yeah. Well,
Barry Prince can testify to what I'm getting ready to say. Kudzu. I mean, my God, they paid money to have people come and cut this stuff down and haul it off. Kudzu is cellulose. It's cellulose. It will burn. It will create and generate, not create, but generate energy. The United States throws away enough cellulose every year that if you converted it into energy, it would supply the entire world with all their energy they need for 6 years. 1 year.
Well, Stephen,
the United States alone throws away enough cellulose to power the world for 6 years. Why are we messing around with radioactive materials?
I don't
why
know.
Why mess around with oil?
Stephen Gibbons posted.
There's other things made from oil other than gasoline and diesel fuel. I mean, they use it to pave roads. It's called asphalt. We make plastics out of it. We make medicines out of it. Why are we burning this stuff as fuel when we have more fuel than we could possibly use just laying outside in your front yard?
Well, I don't know, but Stephen Gibbons posted a deal in the chat room, said the new battery cells use a solid glass electrolyte that conducts either lithium or sodium ions rather than the liquid electrolyte used in today's lithium ion batteries. And so when you talk about that, this not a whole lot different than what I'm talking about, how to literally contain and even utilize what we call waste radioactive material, because even after it's so-called depleted, it's still radioactive. It's still depleting. It's just not efficient enough to run the turbines by generating the steam necessary to do the job. Also, Stephen put in there, John B., good enough. Oh, okay. Has been trying to get this technology out for over 10 years, but as profits would hit, as it cost a lot less, last a lot longer, and can be charged quicker and hold more of a charge than a lithium ion, which he also invented. So if you put a better battery out there, people are going to buy that one as opposed to the other one if it's going to last longer, right? So we're back to money again. Maybe the reason why they ain't resolved Fukushima is they're back to money again. And they're talking about billions of dollars. They're talking about trying to build an ice wall around the core and stuff. Well, you just mentioned earlier about a hydrogen explosion even with depleted uranium. Basically the depleted rods in the cooling pool. If it loses all the cooling water or gets down low enough that it can boil that water, if it's in a closed-in container, can pressurize and basically explode, however the terminology you want to use it, otherwise it's not a good deal, no matter which direction it goes. So you just mentioned terms at that point. But by utilizing materials out there that grab up these isotopes, you can slow that process down to where it'll never even get that hot. The control rods were designed specifically to slow down the reaction by grabbing up the radioactive isotopes as they came off of the rods. It's as simple as that. And then, so if that material works, and you can get a hold of that particular style material and inject it right into that core. You see where I'm going there, guys?
Yes, I do.
I mean, it works in the factory. I mean, it works in the doggone nuclear power plants out there. They've been using it for years. What's
hey,
the... Yeah.
Hi. They injected can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Am I close enough to the mic?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. They injected a ton of radioactive materials from aerial bursts that they were doing with testing with radioactive bombs way back in the day. I have to look to see what the information was, but if you look up documentaries on understanding how lightning works, there's one small section where they'll talk about that and how they thought that was because of all the calculations that they had done. They figured that that would be up there for hundreds of years and no one would be able to fly through the jet stream because of that. And they found after going back for testing and whatnot and sampling that within literally 6 to 8 months it was almost completely neutralized. And they did their investigation. The best they can figure is that when they were, the reason that they were doing it was they were trying to understand how lightning works. So they were testing the storm cloud above the lightning strike, the backlash, the back EMF that comes from the lightning strike. When the lightning strike comes from the cloud
particles that are rubbing together and discharges to the earth, there's a backlash above the cloud. And they're fairly certain that whatever that is, it actually neutralized that radiation. But what if you could use that? That's all plasma, right?
Yeah.
What if you could use that same system with a high voltage, low amperage discharge to create a plasma inside of a spray can?
Yeah.
And spray that gas down into that chamber so that the backlash, the back EMF from it, would shoot back down into where that radioactive material is at and actually neutralize the material itself that's creating all the radiation.
Yeah.
Stabilize it.
See, there's a bit of science out there that not a lot of people were aware of. That's what I'm saying.
Hey, Shaziz, if you could figure that out with your plasma chamber, and it wouldn't be that hard for us to figure out how to put that into a spray can. We could literally make the Mork and Mindy equivalent of Nuke Away.
Well, I need to purchase
but that would be cool.
I need to purchase me a cheap old Geiger counter, and I can get radioactive material out of any existing CO2 detector or smoke detector. There's a material called americium that is basically used to send an energy pulse as it's depleting up to a little circuit that detects that, and then any change in current, which would be like as if smoke came through that beam that was going up to the detector portion of it, and the circuit recognized that there was a change in energy, it would see that there was smoke, and it would start the alarm off, and basically you run out of your house, and you were saved by a piece of radioactive material that was sending constant energy out. The 9-volt battery was only to run the circuit that was detecting the energy.
Hey, you don't know what you've got with that, though. If you want all of that stuff that you're talking about, one simple URL. And just so people know out there, I have nothing to do financially with the company, but we bought from them before, and they've got great products.
Yeah.
UnitedNuclear.com. You can get the Geiger counter. You can get isotope samples that have already been tested and verified. You know exactly what you're working with. So if you neutralize it, you know exactly what to expect when you get a negative reading. You'll know you totally destroyed the radioactive nature of it, restoring it to a stable state.
Well, then there's also the potential that I could use the actual smoke detector or CO2 detector itself as the measuring equipment, such as if I utilize argon gas and I build plasma and I can literally energize a field around that and then be able to blow smoke across that detector and it doesn't detect anything and the thing doesn't go off, then that would tell me or if it goes off to begin with, because now it's no longer, it's neutralized, that means it will detect a change in the field or a change in the energy coming in from it. If it's no longer detecting that energy, then that means that americium has been neutralized, right?
All right.
So there's testing that we could do with the already existing equipment available. So,
we've said before, everything we need has already been invented. All the technology we need to solve all the problems of the world, it's here. We're just not putting it together. Plug and play.
Well, I'm just trying
to understand it, huh?
Like I said when I started this conversation about radiation and all that, I'm not trying to offend nobody or make anybody sound stupid or anything like that. All I'm trying to do is put it in perspective of what stage you're in and basically wherever you're at as far as like right next to the plant, closer to the rod, obviously you're more danger than you would be from me being to you. And to listen to all sides of the story and basically grab up all this information so that you can figure out the method to move forward. So I understand that our world is in trouble because we literally are polluting hand over fist, and it takes a while for nature to break things down. Even the hot radioactive rods that we produce, nature will break them down eventually and put them back to their natural state. No ifs, ands, or buts. It's not even a potential to be denied that nature will break down anything that man has put together. The question is, do we have time to wait around for nature to do the job that nature does, or do we use processes like Thomas just mentioned, which is a brilliant idea, by the way, to literally build a device that will go in there and speed up the process of putting it back to its natural state, which is the uranium that it actually came from out of the ground. And there's people that live around uranium mines all the time. It's natural radiation that they drink the water and seem to be doing just fine. Now, I'm not a doctor. I understand that if people are living around this and they don't show no adverse effects, then it tells me that nature has that portion under control. But when you dig the stuff up out of the dirt and you start cramming it together to deliberately make this more powerful, then you got to understand what's actually occurring that is the danger of radioactive material. Radioactive material is compressed uranium, basically set up to make this rod as hot as possible. You couldn't hold it in your hand because your body's three-quarters covered in water, three-quarters water, and so it would do to your hand what it does to the water in the cooling pool. And unless these radioactive isotopes are slamming into some other material on the way out, at that point in the game, they're not producing gamma rays. And you just basically have a hot radioactive rod, which will burn you and potentially kill you while you're holding this in your hand. So you got to have an understanding of how the process works from start to finish so that you can come to an agreement on the resolution in order how to resolve this. You can slow down that process by cooling down that process. So we have the means right now and the material necessary to literally go over there as a world and clean that mess up so that it's not pumping crud into the ocean. I can understand people being frustrated, and I can understand people panicking to the extent we don't want everybody dying of cancer. We don't want our oceans dying. But if the governments of the world and the alphabet soup agencies listening in are listening to me, and I'm talking common sense to them, I'm not talking about science fiction. I'm talking about science fact, proven technology that already exists. Put these pieces of the puzzle together, go over there, clean up that mess. Once that mess is cleaned up and contained, we can decide how to take that wasted energy and utilize it for the benefit of all humanity. And then all the people that are worried about the world being destroyed can rest knowing that we're actually doing what needs to be done in order to work with nature as opposed to against. I'm not one of those folks who buys into doom and gloom and lack of hope. I know that we were given something amazing by our Creator. And we have a choice of what to do with this something amazing that was given to us by our Creator as long as we utilize the gifts that have been given to us. And until the Doomsday Rock gets here, until the apocalyptic version of life plays out, there is a thing that is called a self-fulfilled prophecy that you can literally bring about your own doom. We got technologies that will sort this whole deal out. But a tool is only a tool when you pick it up, put it in your hand, and utilize it. Otherwise, it's just sitting there. The hammer doesn't build the house by itself. And so, if you're the government agencies out there spying on everybody, and you see that there really definitely is a problem, and you're just not wanting to tell anybody how bad it really is, because you really don't got no answers, I'm giving you the answer right now. We can fix this thing. You just got to pull these people together, the ones that understand all of it. On both sides of the fence. The ones that think that it's so dangerous, and the ones that don't think it's so dangerous. As long as they understand basic science and basic physics and what it is I'm trying to point out, if you can get past the argument stage, you can get the whole situation resolved. And if you got a company like BP still pouring corrective into the ocean, then the Environmental Protection Agency actually needs to do what the Environmental Protection Agency was set up to do, and that's put a stop to it. We got the resolutions for the so-called global warming / climate change due to man-made emissions. We got the answers to resolve that. We got the answers to clean up the messes that's been made by man over the last 50 to 100 years or more. We got all the technology necessary right here, right now, to literally come together and clean this doggone mess up before this mess cleans us up.
The biggest problem is there's no money in it.
Well, if there's no money in it...
As long as there's no money in it, big money people are not going to invest in it. They don't care.
If there's no money in it and humanity dies broke as a joke, then humanity's still dead.
And they deserve it.
If I don't care how much money out there in this world, you put all the gold you want in your pocket, but you ain't taking it with you. So what's the point? The point, you know, is that if we got these problems and you don't fix it, all the money in the world ain't going to make it easier for you to breathe out there in the crud. And if you got to
save your children's lives.
No, it's not.
My God, you know, she says, you know, we talk about nuclear. We better come up with solutions that can correct these things, because Fukushima is just one problem. We have the potential on this planet for dozens and dozens of Fukushima-like events to unfold, based on the fact that we built these nuclear power plants in striking range to fault lines, and they're all eventually going to have major problems. It's only a matter of time. So we better come up with the solutions, because we see the results from Fukushima, and that is just one major problem. We have got lots more coming in the near future, because of where we built these plants, the age, the cooling system. Every nuclear power plant now seems to be having problems. We see scrams going on a regular basis. It's only a matter of time before we see more of these Fukushima-like events on the planet. So we better come up with the solutions to fix it, and we better shut nuclear power down completely on this planet in the next 10, 15, or 20 years, or there ain't going to be a life on this planet, Shaziz. Period.
We had,
and that's not fear. That's not fear monger. That's being honest and realistic.
It's true.
When I was younger, I worked in construction work, and I helped build 3 nuclear power plants. And at that particular time, the best nuclear power plant built was only designed to run for 35 or 40 years. And that was like 60 or 80 years ago, and they're still running them. Why? Why are we having problems? Because they run them 3 to 4 times beyond their lifespan. Get rid of the dingo nuclear power plant and go to cellulose.
What I tried to say, I don't know how many times, see, a lot of people are worried about burning fossil fuels to generate electricity. Well, that's safer than radiation. Everybody's got to admit that. And you can filter the exhaust. But nonetheless,
with the fossil fuel,
we had, back in the late 1800s, a device that would put nuclear power to shame as far as being able to heat water into steam. And that was using all natural stuff. Now, keep in mind, the mercury arc rectifier that I'm talking about had mercury in it, and that's not really what you want to use in case of any kind of deal. You don't want nobody getting mercury poisoning. But we still have several noble gases that we can use in this place in order to literally build a plasma system that will generate enough heat to literally boil water. And that's all we're doing is boiling water. With hot radioactive material, we're boiling water. And because the way it's compacted in, it's like a firecracker. Once you light the fuse, then it's going to go off. And the only way that you can control that reaction is to basically make the fuse a little longer or put something as a buffer in between there, like the radioactive rods or something, you know. So you slow the reaction down, but nonetheless, if you lose one portion of that system, then those things are already cocked and loaded and ready to go. You stop cooling them down, you pressurize the water, heat the water, superheat the water into steam, the steam pressurizes, the compression, the electrical discharge involved in separating hydrogen and oxygen, and you get compression ignition, which causes the doggone thing to either implode or explode, no matter how you look at it. It's a mess. So we know this. But we could have resolved it back in the late 1800s before it ever even started. So if we had that technology back then, we can utilize that technology now. We can basically work, because you're not going to be able to just shut these plants down like you'd think. You're going to have to utilize that fuel until it's done and hope for the best up until the point when you finally get it depleted enough to put down in cooling ponds, and then shut it down, not turn it back on. And from that point, it's just a matter of waiting it out. It's a matter of figuring out the method by which Thomas was talking about, where you literally are able to neutralize this back into its natural state. There is a process out there to neutralize this back into its natural state. You just got to learn from what nature does. And if my understanding of what Thomas explained, nature's already proven, and past science experiments have already proven that nature has something in the atmosphere that will literally neutralize the reaction that's going on with this material. So we need to look at that research, and we need to find out what was in the atmosphere when they were doing these researches, whether it had to do with plasma technology or high voltage or whatever process out there. It's like this. If you take any magnet, no matter what kind of magnet it is, permanent magnet, ceramic, or earth magnet, rare earth magnet, whatever, if you heat that magnet up, it will lose its magnetic field. Period. It's no longer a magnet. And you can remagnetize that same material. But you do know right now that by heating that up, you can destroy that magnetic field. So with every chemical out there, with every material out there, you can do the same thing. You just got to find the right process in order to make it happen. I believe we have the technology right now to literally start neutralizing all the radioactive waste on this planet until it's back down to its natural state, being uranium.
Okay, so Ziv, I'm a layman, and I don't understand about nuclear power much. Are you telling me that I cannot shut down a nuclear power plant in 2 or 3 days and completely stop all the reactions and put it away safely?
No, because
I have to wait. I'm talking from a layman's point of view, because most people don't understand this, that a nuclear power plant can't be just shut down.
That's correct. Because that's because those rods are still really hot, and they have to be cooled. And their cooling process is the same process that they use to produce the steam. The hot radioactive rods are boiling the water to the extreme that it actually turns into steam pressure.
Correct.
And so you can't just shut it down, because now you have those still hot rods, and because they're basically, I want to say, a solid state, it's material that's already compacted. It's like a firecracker ready to go off. And unless you
keep you got a firecracker with no on-off switch.
Yeah, and that's why I said that the nuclear industry was stupid for doing that, because if anything goes wrong, the process isn't going to stop because those are still hot.
Well, that's kind of insane, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, well, of course, I mean, all of a sudden there's a national disaster. We've got to shut this nuclear power plant down, and what? We can't turn them off? Wait a sec. Hold on.
The best
something wrong.
The best that you can do is use the control rods to reduce the reaction down to a safe level where it's no longer boiling the water. The reaction is still occurring, but the control rods are grabbing up the radioactive isotopes as they're being released from the rods. And so...
So combined around the planet, we have thousands of these little control rods activated right now, and we have no way of shutting them down, and they're all sitting on top of fault lines that are going to rupture at one point in the very near future.
Well,
that doesn't sound very, very logical to me.
No, it ain't. And unless you can keep power to any system that is going to keep a continuous flow of cool water on those rods, then they will boil the existing water or even the atmosphere in that general vicinity to the point. And if it's a sealed container, such as a building, then it will build up enough pressure to literally produce enough heat that will literally produce enough circumstances to cause compression ignition.
The only true way to shut down a nuclear power plant, Barry, is to actually run it down until it's run out of fuel.
That's right. You got to run the batteries out.
Exactly.
That's insane, folks.
Think
about that. That's absolutely beyond insanity to make something with this potential and not have an automatic shutdown system for it. Should never allowed to be brought on the planet Earth.
That's why when this technology first came to the forefront, that's why there were so many people opposed to it. Scientists including were opposed to nuclear power plants because of the process of how they actually produce these rods and what occurs after that. It's like magnesium or lithium. Let's use lithium better for a better example. Lithium in water has a instantaneous violent reaction. Those two chemicals. All right. So once the lithium's produced, you got to keep it out of the atmosphere for one, because it's going to interact with any moisture molecules in the air. It has a violent reaction with water. And so, but once that lithium is actually produced, you have to keep it contained. You can't just go dump it in a doggone bucket of water and expect nothing to occur. It's a ticking time bomb right there in itself. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing applies with the radioactive rods. Once it's produced, if you can't contain it, then you've got a problem. And why they would put something together like that with the potential of anything going wrong, you know, a crack in the ground, water gushes in on the lithium, and there you have a violent reaction.
Or a major earthquake destroying all the cooling systems.
Yeah.
Boom!
So, I know that mankind must be crazy. Seriously.
Well, somebody was crazy.
But,
I don't think mankind's crazy.
But
somebody's definitely insane.
If we take and utilize the knowledge available to us, and we take the prior research, like Thomas spoke about earlier, and find means by which to actually neutralize the material to the extent to where it's no longer going to be hot enough to pressurize a sealed container, we could get this under control, clean up the environment, and have nature, you know, working with us instead of against us. Right now, we ain't made nature happy. And nature's showing us that nature's not happy. You're getting crazy storms around the planet because people are jacking with things that they shouldn't be jacking with. It's as simple as that. Heat rises, cold air falls. If you throw hot water into the ocean, you're going to cause a reaction to occur. It's going to move something. The cold water will sink to the bottom. The heat, hot water will rise to the top. In the process of that, you get some sort of movement going on. You do this on a large enough scale, you can literally move the Gulf Stream over, which in turn will change the weather all the way down the line. And if you're the poor, unfortunate fish that swim in this water, and you're used to a certain temperature, Everyone who's ever had a fish tank understands that fish are temperature sensitive, and if you get it too hot, the fish will die. If it's too cold, the fish will die. And so it's a balancing act that nature has figured out over all these years that the planet has been here, and nature keeps everything temperature sensitive, temperature controlled, and does what nature does. And fish live happily ever after, and they have children, and so on down the line. But if you're heating up the water and putting crud over on the other side of the water, and all these things are in conjunction with each other, kicking the fish to the curb, like I said, Barry, it ceases to be a conspiracy theory when birds start falling from the sky.
You start opening up fish's stomachs and find them full of plastic because there's nothing left for them to eat in the ocean. You know it's not a conspiracy anymore, and that's what we're seeing, that animals are starving to death on the West Coast here, Shaziz, and I'm reading reports about it every day. They're opening up fish, and all they're finding is plastic because the fish are looking for something to eat. The food source is disappearing. Sardine industry in California is just about totally collapsed now. Same thing's happening in Oregon, Washington State. They shut down the commercial fisheries. We're seeing it up here now. People are talking about it left, right, and center, that the ocean's in trouble. My God, folks, we kill the ocean, we got nothing.
Well,
and we ain't got a lot of time, she says, to correct these problems. I'm not a fear-mongering type of guy. I'm not. But I got to get right in people's faces and let them know that we got to become active. Not trying to make you scared. I'm trying to tell you that if we don't get active, you're going to have to talk to your kids in 10 years and tell them why you didn't get active.
Yeah.
Because this information's out there right now, folks. It's not bull.
Well,
it's fact.
When I talk to people about this, I don't want them to think that I'm trying to make light of the situation, because the situation is dire. It really does need to be resolved. But what I want to put it into is a calm perspective of what's occurring, where it's occurring, so that everybody can understand the process enough to find the resolutions to ensure that this doesn't get worse than what it is right now. You see what I'm saying? I'm not discounting all the folks out there that are talking about the dangers of. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we have to put it in perspective so that we can understand, okay, at this particular feat right here, we're safe enough to take our backhoes and dig a moat around this entire deal and seal it so it ain't getting through this way and contain it right here. And then from that point on, we drill up underneath the ground to where we can see from thermal imaging, whether it be a satellites or an airplane or whatever, exactly where the hottest spot is at. And we inject into that spot the materials necessary to slow down the reaction, starting with what they built the rods from to begin with, the control rods. And from that point on, send in liquid nitrogen to literally freeze up that, to slow down that process yet even further. So now that we can move in just a little bit closer, because that radioactivity has gone down further. You see what I'm saying? And you can tell where the hot spots are. That's what the Geiger counter tells you whenever it's going off. It's showing a release, you know. It's picking up these rays as they're being released off of there and slamming into other molecules in the air.
Well, we got to come up with a solution pretty quick, Shaziz. That's all I know.
Well,
and why every scientist in the world isn't working on it.
I'm laying
is the
it out.
I have.
I'm giving you the solution right now. If anybody can speak Japanese well enough to translate what I'm trying to say to the folks in charge over there, and they will humor me long enough to at least try it, because so far what they've got going on, it ain't succeeding, because there's 6,000 employees over there that have to change their clothes every day into new clothes, and so there's contaminated clothing that is piling up. The water that they're circulating through there basically has to be stored in huge tanks, and they're running out of space to put that. Why can't they use the same exact water and some really good filtration systems to grab up the any stray pieces of the material that the control rods is made out of, to literally store it in containers instead of, you know, in the water bucket? You understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, everything they're doing over there is insane.
Yeah.
Because storage containers they're building are now starting to leak. I mean, they're putting radioactive water in storage containers that they say have a 5-year shelf life. Well, what's going to happen after 5 years?
But see,
where's all that water going to go?
See, Barry, the point is, it's not the water in those containers that's dangerous. The water is the most stable molecule in existence on the planet. It's not the water itself. If they filtered that water, they can reuse that water for the same cooling process. It's the material.
Why are they doing that, Jesus?
I have no idea. I mean, to me, it's pure ridiculousness that they don't understand the basic concept of what I'm saying. You can filter that water, you can pull out any radioactive isotopes that's in that water, and you can store it in a completely different container, not compacted like you would for a normal fuel rod. That's the problem to begin with, but the material that they're using for the fuel rods that's damaged because of the explosion or implosion, whichever side of the fence you fall on there. But nonetheless, you can filter that water. The water itself is not radioactive.
Right.
It is the materials within the water that can be filtered, and you can reuse that water over and over and over again using the thermal heat exchanger, just like the radiator in your car. If they took the time, they could run around and they could grab up old tractors and freaking old air conditioners and take all the cores of this stuff, put a filtration system on the water tank, run that water in through the system that where the air is blowing through there, or they could put fans on it or whatever. All you need is that to transfer the heat out of that water so that when the water gets down there, it can take away more heat from the system and then recirculate the water again. Refilter it and then repump it right back through. You don't have to have all these tanks of water laying around that could potentially leak out into the deal.
Well, it sounds like a better idea than dumping thousands of gallons of seawater on it every day and having it run back into the ocean.
Yeah.
Because that's what they're doing.
If what I'm saying is wrong, Barry, if what I'm saying is wrong, how is it that you can actually grab up the uranium or americium or any of the radioactive materials that they use in smoke detectors or CO2 detectors? If it can be grabbed up, then that means it could be filtered out of that water because they got it in some process or another to begin with, right? And then they were able to take all this and compact it into a ceramic rod and then put it inside of they got little metal shells that actually go around each individual rod that basically holds all this stuff in together. And basically a heat transfer system. So if you can use it in your doggone smoke detector, that means they were able to get a hold of it before and they can get a hold of it again. They can basically filter out that water, reuse that water over and over and over again, and even benefit from the doggone thermal exchange. Heck, we got Peltier elements that are literally working off a temperature difference that you could slap a whole panel of those up next to these radiators and take the heat off of that to generate electricity. So even in the process of cleaning up the mess, you can get some energy out of the system to run your lighting system, for Pete's sake, so that you don't have to worry about not being able to see at night. Keep the thing running 24/7 until you deplete all the energy and neutralize all the fuel, and then now you got the mess cleaned up.
Well, we better get you over to Japan and get you in front of a group of scientists over there, Suzette, because if we don't put a stop to this soon, I don't want to see what's coming in the future.
Well,
I really don't. And like I said, we're only talking about Fukushima right now. Really, I think if the whole world understood how nuclear power worked, really understands the fact that once these things are working, it's not an on-off switch that we can't shut them off. And they're going to be going for a long time until that fuel is actually spent.
Yeah.
If the whole human race could actually grasp the concept of this and the potential for disaster.
It's the truth.
And really understand what we're looking at here a few years down the road. I say that because, you know, these geological events are going to happen. It's inevitable that fault lines are going to continue to move and we're going to continue to see large earthquakes in striking range of these nuclear power plants. That one would only have to use common sense to understand that this is something. You're telling me that we can't stop it now. Well, my God, we're going to have to come up with a solution to completely neutralize it, to stop all reaction, and like you said, bring it back to its natural state. That, I think, is going to be the cry, because we're going to have to come up with a way to shut these things down, not in 10 or 20 years or 30 years, but overnight. So that's the technology I think we really have to explore, because there's a way to neutralize all reactions inside these plants and make them stable and be able to eliminate them in a short period of time.
You guys want to hold down the fort for a second? I got to go take a nature break. So keep talking.
Well, as long as it's not radioactive and it's not affecting your toilet, Shaziz, go ahead. Have you checked the lining in your toilet lately?
Yes, it's lead, man.
Really, like, you know, Raymond, I this is the one thing that I cannot in my life, I'm having a really hard time understanding exactly how nuclear power was ever brought in, what these people were thinking about when they brought it to the Earth. They had to know that one day that we were going to see the problems we're seeing now. They had to know that.
I can explain it. They needed a bomb to kill a lot of people to bring a war to an end. And then they realized that there was an unbelievable amount of power there. So if they could control the explosion, then they could suck a little bit of the power off at a time. But what they were trying to do is take a stick of dynamite with a dynamite cap and a fuse, light the fuse, and then figure out a way to control the explosion before the fuse actually set it off.
Exactly.
Exactly what they did. They were hoping that they could build these nuclear power plants and then figure out, while they were running, figure out how to handle the spent fuel, because they knew the spent fuel would be radioactive. The problem is, it's like Shaziz said, the fuel is considered spent fuel. When it reaches a point, it will not boil water and produce steam at a certain pressure. But it's still producing heat more than enough to boil water. It just won't boil water at the higher temperature of the pressure of heat, of steam that they have. In other words, you know yourself, the more pressure you put on water, the higher the boiling point is.
Right.
It raises the actual boiling point. So spent fuel will actually boil water.
Yeah.
But it just won't water produce steam under pressure.
So that...
The whole secret is, what they did is build the nuclear power plant because they figured out a way to control the explosion, slow it down, so they could suck some heat out of it to make steam. But they did not know how to control, handle the spent fuel. They just hoped. They hoped. I think would learn how before they had a lot of spent fuel, but it didn't work.
Well, essentially, you started a chemical chain reaction with the way that they designed the rods to begin with, so that once these things were put together, they would have to be carefully handled, and they would have to be continuously cooled, because otherwise the process would basically cause a meltdown. And so if you're a science guy, and you understand what's actually occurring in those rods, and you're standing there and you're telling these folks back then, which they did have science guys back then that were saying, this is really not a good idea, because if you have any kind of failure, you're going to have a serious issue. Alright, now, if you had these, open to the atmosphere itself, and they were able to completely melt down because there's hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen in there, you could literally get an open air explosion from it. That's one of the concerns, the big mushroom cloud popping up over Japan or anywhere there's a radioactive material that's being depleted like that. But if you know the physics of the whole entire deal, and you can manage to keep the doggone thing under control by keeping the temperature down, then at that stage in the game, nuclear power is wonderful. It's not a problem. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
But the problem is, they've had a problem, and it's created a mess. And in the process of it, their version of how to fix it has, like, really went awry. Stephen Gibbons posted a link in there. Contact them yourself, Shaziz, at www.4.tepco.com. Cool. Okay, I'm clicking on that link right now. I'll see if there's anybody over there that hablos Ingles, and we'll have a talk.
Well, you could write them a letter and see what they say, Shaziz. If you write them a letter or an email, they might just read it, and you never know where that would go.
Well, anything's got to be better than what they're doing right now. We got filtration systems right now that'll get things down to the micron level. I mean, basically you can filter water to almost perfect clarity. So there's no reason why we couldn't do the same thing with what they have access to work with and actually pull out any contamination that's in that water. Like I said,
well, I hope they look at this, because they're not doing a very good job right now, Shaziz.
Like I said,
they don't have the answer.
It's not the water itself that's radioactive. It's the contamination that's in the water that is doing what it's doing. And once you understand that and you filter it out, you can start to put things where they need to be. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they're not where they need to be. They're... I don't know who's running the show over there, but, you know, if it's still going on 6 years after, then apparently they are not doing something right.
They don't have the answers, Shaziz. That's what the bottom line is. They don't have the answers.
Well,
right now they're kind of in a non-gone zone before uncharted territory. And really, now we're starting to see the problems that nuclear power plants can create. Boy, I tell you, we got more coming in the future, Caesar. So let's get a solution out there. Let's hopefully stimulate some young minds into looking into some solutions. Because, like I said earlier, I think we're going to have to come up with a way of neutralizing the whole process right back to where it was before it was started. And if we can do that, then I can see potentially cleaning up the mess.
Well,
but if we're looking at power plants that can't be stopped until the fuel rods are spent, and then the storage time and all the other potentials, with that kind of scenario, you know, I don't see a good ending to it.
Well, here's the way I look at it, man. If nature has the capability, if man has the capability of putting something together, and nature has the capability of taking it back apart again, being natural processes and deterioration and stuff, then that process, you can learn from nature on how things, you know, deteriorate. You know, like we got special materials that we can put on other materials that will make them last longer, not corrode or oxidize and stuff. And so knowing all this stuff right here, that there's ways to slow down the process of what nature does, there's also ways to speed up the process, such as if I wet down a piece of steel and put some salt or some, you know, like rock salt like they put on the streets, I'm going to obviously cause that piece of metal to rust faster than it would have normally if it was just out in the air by itself. You see what I mean? Yeah, no. Hello. Must have lost.
Oh, sorry. I was muted out. I hate that, man. I hate that. Really, you know, okay, nature's going to do what nature does, but if nature dies, then nature's not going to be able to do what nature does. And if nature becomes more and more depleted and more weak as we go on, nature's not going to be able to fight back against what it's being invaded with. And
well,
you know what? Really, nuclear power to me is beyond insanity. I don't see a good ending to it. We got to figure out a way to get it off the planet.
Nature's not going to get weak. Nature's not going to be weakened by the process in any way. What nature's going to do is get extremely violent and more extremely violent as the process goes. The more things get out of hand, the more nature fights back, and the harder nature's going to, you know, slap things down to balance it back. Nature's in control. We're just making nature mad right now.
We understand that. But it's all one mechanism that's under attack.
Yeah.
So if you kill the mechanism, then nature has no way of doing what nature is going to do.
Yeah.
I'm not saying nature isn't an incredible mechanism. I'm saying nature's being subjected to pollutants and ways of destruction that I don't believe she's ever been experienced to before. We don't know how she's going to react. We know the food chain's a part of nature. That it's all one part of one one beautiful thing that works together. The food, the fish, the oceans, the air, it all works together. And we are taking out major parts left, right, and center.
Yeah.
We don't know what the end result is going to be, but we know the food chain depends on itself to function.
Yeah.
And we are taking huge pieces out of it. We're destroying the biosphere. We're destroying our oceans. we don't know if nature's going to be able to rebound from something like this, because I don't believe nature's ever been subjected to this kind of abuse in the history of this planet. That's what I'm saying, folks.
Yeah, I agree. It's a mess. We don't want to find out the hard way, but we're heading down that path. What I'm saying is, right now, while we have the opportunity, before it's all said and done, right now is the time to get proactive and get some accomplished. Now that I got this link right here to TEPCO, I'm going to send them a message to see if I get a response. If I get a response, I will sit down and have a conversation with them, and I'll share that conversation with all you folks, and then we'll see where we go to from there. Maybe they've already thought of what I've talked about. Maybe they haven't. And any perspective from any direction. This link is now posted into the superchat.html room, so if you guys got ideas, you send them a message too. If they see you're concerned on this side and you have options available and they're willing to try it, I say we got the tools and the technology to, at the very least, contain it, and using a little bit of research from the past to be able to basically make it neutral again. There's ways to take all kinds of different, what normally would be classified as toxic materials, and basically neutralize them using tricks of chemistry and, you know, basically make it safe again for the environment. I've seen this firsthand. And so with that said, it's a matter of the brilliant minds come to the table, resolve the issue, or we just let it keep on going down the commode like it is right now, and deal with the consequences when it's done. The consequences may be the case that we ain't around anymore. I kind of like to stick around if you don't mind, and I'd like to see everybody else do the same.
Yeah, I ain't going down that one of destruction. We're going to try and do what we can do to make people aware, but we are in a real pickle, and I really feel a sense of urgency as far as getting people involved, which is this, and making them aware how much potential we are looking at in the very, very near future. And we've got to base that on what we see going on right now. It doesn't take a rocket science to figure out that, you know, if we're losing mammals at the rate that we are on this planet, then what are we looking at 20 or 30 or 40 years down the road? And really, that's what we got to look at. We got to look at our legacy, folks, and what we're leaving for our children. Right now, we're leaving them one big pile of poop to deal with.
It's the little organisms that you can't see that the little bit bigger organisms use for food source, that the little bit bigger organisms, all the way up to the fish, all the way up to the big mammals and stuff, you're cutting off their food supply if you're killing the plankton, and there's nothing else to replenish that for the little bit bigger life forms that eat the smaller life forms, and so on down the line. And nature's so far out of balance at this point that you got to get your act together, because it's only a matter of time when the first domino tips until the last domino falls, and the last domino is we the people. Now, if the governments can't get their act together, and the corporations can't get their act together, if they're all in it for the money and the short term of it all, I want to get rich, I want to maintain power, and if things hit the fan, I'll just go down in my bunker, they're fooling themselves. Because you can only store so much food in any given spot, unless you make a completely, totally self-contained biosphere that can replicate nature. In your process, you're going to have a flaw somewhere in the system where that thing's going to come back to bite you in your butt. You can't duplicate nature. You can learn from nature, and you can replicate it to you the best extent to work in harmony with nature, but there's no way you can cover all bases enough to basically resolve the issues that we got problems with.
Exactly, and we're in uncharted territory as far as nature goes, because really we don't know. We know what we're seeing now, but we really don't know what is going to come in the next 15 years, and I don't think we want to go there, because she's telling us right now that she's in big, big trouble, and we really got to help her, guys, period. Or else her children aren't going to have a planet to live on, and I honestly believe it. And that's not being a fearmonger. That's being honest, the way I see it. Go ahead. Thanks for having me in today, Shazis.
I agree, and you're more than welcome. It's always an honor to have you in. I know there's a lot of passion on this subject, and I kind of frustrate people because I'm trying to explain something to them, but I want people to understand at what stage what the amount of danger is and so on, so that you can understand how to even deal with this material. You understand what I'm trying to point out here? I'm not trying to diminish anybody's concerns or make light of the actual danger, but there are realities to science, such as if you're holding it directly in your hand, obviously you're not safe. You're going to get burned. But at a certain extent, knowing how the process actually works, the more you know about the process itself, the better you're going to be equipped to finding a solution to containment and to ultimately neutralize any waste that is out there. Even this crud that the BP has poured into the ocean, at some point in time, nature can straighten it back out. But at the rate that it's going into the ocean and the damage that it's doing, it's spreading out all over the place. And it's just basically causing a cataclysmic self-fulfilled prophecy, such as spraying crud in the air. Why would you do that? You know? And you can't argue with people about it, because the people out there will tell you, well, you know, they don't do that. The government wouldn't do that. You know, well, go back and look at history. Go back and look at Vietnam, chemicals such as Agent Orange, where they were trying to defoliate the landscape so the enemy wouldn't have a place to hide, and how they would put silver iodide into the clouds to try to seed the clouds to get it to rain so that the trails would be so muddy they couldn't get their equipment from point A to point B. So then turn around after you've done that research and come back to me and tell me that your government wouldn't pull these shenanigans. All right, maybe they think they're saving the world by blocking out something. Or maybe they're just stupid. But nonetheless, we don't have time to find out which side of the fence they're on, whether it's the stupid or the insanity or whatever. We got to get the brilliant people to the table. We got to get in contact with the people who are actually on the ground and can actually do something with this. You'd think the most brilliant scientist in the world could have resolved this in an easy fashion by now. 6 years into it, I don't see the concern that I should be seeing. From whether it be the people or the governments in general, I don't see the concern. And when I don't see the concern and I throw in there guys like Galen Windsor, who says what he says about the dangers of radiation or the lack thereof, or the hierarchy that runs the control mechanism that says who can be exposed to what, well, it kind of, I have questions, and until these questions are answered, we're not getting nothing done. If Galen Windsor's right, then the government's been screwing you out of free energy all these years. If Galen Windsor's wrong, then we've got a serious issue that the government's not addressing in the manner in which to resolve it, so that we don't lose our fish and our people and our wildlife or animals or plants or whatever, our environment. Once we lose our environment, when the biosphere is cracked up, then guess what? We go down the hill. Nature will balance itself back out at some time, but we won't be here to see it. So we're racing the clock as humanity. Nature's got things under control to the extent that nature can do it, but you can't keep polluting the doggone thing and expect to live in that particular area while you're toxifying the water. You see what I mean?
Absolutely. You can't expect nature to function the way nature is supposed to function when we're killing her.
And if the
polluting her and adding all kinds of new organisms that she's never seen before.
If the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is telling you, the people, just wait for the crud to float by and then start drinking the water again, then fire the EPA. They work for you. Fire them. Put in place somebody who will really protect the environment, as opposed to the ones who have the name Environmental Protection Agency but are willing to allow the crud to float downstream, causing untold damage and devastation to the ecosystem in that stream, and then tell you, the people, oh, don't worry, when the crud floats by, then you can take a drink. That's it, man.
I have to leave now, Shizabiz. I have an appointment in about 15 minutes I have to be at. So
all right,
I have
well,
to say goodbye and say happy end.
Yeah, this is the end of the Mad Science Show anyway. So, folks, if you've been listening in and you agree with anything we have to say or even disagree, come to the table. Let's sort it out. Let's work it out. Let's get the solutions on the table. Get people motivated to help us all fix whatever needs to be fixed and make this world a better place for everybody. That's what Mad Science is all about. So, any last words, guys? No? Yeah?
No, not long enough for me to go into a rant. Thanks for having me. Thanks for meeting.
No problem.
And, yeah, we'll talk again tomorrow on the Knights of the Round Table there, Shizzes.
All right, cool. See y'all tomorrow, okay. Knights of the Round Table. If you want to join us in, www.shizzesradio.com. If you learned anything or enjoyed this podcast and agree or disagree and want to share the information out there with the world, appreciate it if you share it on your social media networks and invite people to the chat room to talk with us. Invite them to Skype conversations and let's work things out and get it resolved. So with that said, yeah.
I got two words. Think cellulose.
Yep.
Okay.
Cool. All right. Peace and love, everybody.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.